In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome. Thank you for being here. We are recording this on Friday, October 10th, because of the market holiday on Monday. A lot to talk about nonetheless. A lot is going on right now as we're recording this. So we'll get into that in the market update. There's some renewed trade negotiations or kind of fighting between us, the US and China. Also, the government shutdown is still big news. Both chambers are about to take a long weekend here while that's still unresolved, and a lot of government workers are either furloughed or are working without being paid. So we'll get into that a little bit as well. And then we're going to go into just a little bit of a 101 on mortgage-backed securities. So last week we talked to Justin Monahan of TradeWeb, and he gave us a bit of the, history and technical background of how MBS are traded and priced. We wanted to just really take a step kind of sideways and go back to just what is an MBS? Why does it exist? How did it start? Why is it super unique in this country? What does the market look like? How does it affect mortgage rates? So we'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. Before we get into the market update, OBMMI, we are around 6.3, but it will be lower after today's market activity, it seems. Equities are off big, and the 10-year is down close to 4 right about now. So pretty heavy psychological level there for the 10-year. We're still hoping to get, a 5 handle, but even being in the low 6s lately, we're seeing volume elevated. You're probably seeing a lot of articles about it lately. Refinances are up very big. Purchase business is starting to pick up as well, even in this odd season where we typically don't see that in the fourth quarter. But yeah, we're seeing, what you're reading about in those articles. You may hear us quoted, but we are, even if you don't, we are seeing that in the OB data as well, just seeing, increasing refi activity. All right, let's go talk with the team about what's going on in the market. All right, welcome team. Welcome, welcome. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on across the world, but also in our own country this past week or so, where it would probably start with the government shutdown. What are we on day 10? Today's Friday. We're recording on Friday because of the Monday holiday. Government still kind of back and forth escalating between the chambers, between the Republicans and Democrats. It's kind of, I guess, typical in these situations. Each side blames the other for the continuation of it. Furloughs are taking place. I don't know. I was traveling the last couple of days, but I didn't see a lot in the way of delays. But I guess historically when these things happen, furloughed workers, they're not getting paid as they're working. I guess they get paid in arrears once the shutdown ends, but it does lead to things like burnout and people take a lot more sick time, and that's starting to affect things like air traffic control and some other critical functions, right? The folks that are working right now. And obviously the non-critical, that's becoming a little messy, almost literally, well, very literally as well. Like things like the bathrooms at the national parks, right, aren't being attended to. Anyway, Alex, you got some good notes on this. Like, where do you see this today? And I don't know. Do you feel like there's any way to predict the prospects of this or how long it lasts?
Yeah, like you said, it's day 10. All the major news outlets are kind of flying as blind as we are on this. It doesn't seem to be any into the shutdown in sight. You know, Democrats are sticking hard and fast to their Obamacare tax credits that they want to preserve, seeing, you know, healthcare costs via the Affordable Care Act skyrocketing if they were done away with. Republicans, you know, just pushing to get a budget through so they can end this whole thing. But yeah, there really doesn't seem to be much, you know, reaching across the aisle at the moment to get this resolved. From a broad economy standpoint, I think, you know, as we come up on, you know, one full pay period, everyone, as you said, will be paid in arrears. I think that's going to start becoming painful because, you know, regardless of what you might personally think, you know, the size of the U.S. federal government should be, it is a major employer throughout the country, you know, more so in certain jurisdictions than others. But at the end of the day, you know, large swaths of people aren't getting paid, and it just makes it difficult to make ends meet, you know, and that has avalanche effects throughout the economy. You know, if you're not getting paid, you might not be able to, you know, pay your credit card bill on time and stuff like that. So Senate is going home for the weekend, for the long weekend. Good on them. But yeah, they're going to reconvene on Tuesday, which I guess kind of tells you, you know, how seriously they view it. If you can take a weekend off, they don't view it as, you know, quite dire yet. We did get a military spending bill pushed through the Senate late last night that will ensure that, you know, military members, of which there's a million plus or so of active duty members in the military, they'll be paid during this period. So, you know, a little bit of a reprieve there. But again, the main pain point that I see as this stretches on is just all those federal workers who are going without a paycheck for the time being.
Yeah. We also saw this morning that the government may be going through with laying off federal workers completely, which was a threat they had. And so seems like a little bit of movement this morning. There's already lawsuits being filed against that, but that's one to watch out for, which is not normal during a government shutdown to have layoffs like this. But that, of course, that's been a threat by the administration, and looks like they're going to try to follow through with that as of this morning.
Yeah, I mean, the politicians might not think that this is a big deal, but you made good points there, Alex. I mean, real people, the largest employer in the country is not paying their employees. So there's folks that this could lead to short-term delinquency issues, certainly could have effects on things like inflation, probably in a negative way, in a downward, right? People may stop spending money. Retail sales start dropping. I think in general, this is going to a little bit of maybe grassroots animosity from those employees as it relates to their employer. Yeah, there's definitely far further reaching implications than just what's in the headlines, it feels like today.
And I remember in 2019, I think the last time we went around this, and Jim, you mentioned this earlier with air traffic control being short-staffed and potential ripples we start to see there. Remember that reaching a pretty fever pitch last time around, once we started having, you know, like ground stops and things due to short staffing. So it seems like maybe we've seen a little bit of that. But, you know, I feel like that's one thing to watch for, you know, as time goes on, is if we start to see more of that, I think that's really going to ramp the pressure up for folks to just strike a deal.
You would think so. Just the grassroots component of it, right, affecting real people, and that starting to get into the news and maybe potentially getting uglier. I think it would be motivation, you would think, for both sides to get something done, and the pressure would start to build, especially, you know, hopefully nothing bad happens, right? I mean, there's a lot of these, you know, we're getting the military piece pushed through, which is first and foremost, right? Security of the country is very important, but there's other areas of government that do a lot of good things around the country. So you would hope that, yeah, nothing kind of falls through the cracks during this period.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, a lot of folks in the mortgage industry getting ready to hop on a plane to go to Vegas in, you know, another 10 days or so. You know, another thing to be aware of as this is playing out.
Yeah, in our small part of the world, the country.
Small silver lining this morning, though, I did see a headline, I think Jeff posted it, about they are going to bring back furloughed BLS members to get the CPI number out next week. So we were not expecting to see a CPI number just because we weren't expecting this shutdown to be resolved by midweek next week. They are going to get the CPI number out. And it sounds as if that's mainly because this is the end of the accounting period for calculating Social Security inflation for next year. So they have to get this number out for that Social Security number to be accurate next year.
So we'll probably see the employment report from last month as well, in addition to getting those CPI numbers out. So we'll see when both of those come out sometime next week, presumably.
Good. That's probably a welcome development. It's an interesting technicality that they're using to push that through. So that's positive. But also, yeah, there's been a lot more talk about the labor situation, and folks are using different proxies at this point, from Wall Street analysts to ADP, and just everything kind of looks pretty negative. So it will be interesting to see what that official report says and how it compares to the last few and some of the revisions. So yeah, looking forward to seeing that here soon. Otherwise, I mean, not much of movement in rates because of the shutdown, but we did have some developments just as we were getting ready to record this podcast today that have pushed the equity market, pushed all markets around pretty heavily. So when you're all listening to this on Monday, the market will be closed, but you will remember that on Friday, at this point, the equities are down like 2%. The 10-year is closing in on 4%, like really seeing a big shift in the market. And a big reason for that was just continued policy fighting between the U.S. and China over trade issues once again.
And some backstory there, China had instituted a new policy regarding the exports of rare earth minerals that is, you know, more restrictive. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, nuance in the details there. But there is, you know, a response from the administration reacting negatively to that and threatening high percentage of tariffs back at China in retaliation. And so it might be a good reminder, if we zoom out, almost all of the gains in the S&P 500 over the last 3 years or so are concentrated in a very small number, you know, 10 or less firms that, you know, mostly related to the AI boom. And of course, AI relies on chips, and chips need rare earth minerals. So it all sort of ties back together, at least, you know, in the equity market side of the house. But that's some of the context behind what we're seeing between China and the administration, you know, going back and forth today.
Just what it felt like, tariff talk was dying down a little bit. You know, the actual implied tariffs being charged weren't nearly as high as what we, you know, what happened, what was being discussed during Liberation Day. Kind of felt like we were getting through it, right? The inflation numbers weren't as bad because of tariffs, and now it just pops back up. So just a reminder that I think the tariff conversation is not going to go away probably for a long time, and we're going to have flare-ups like this probably for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the frog boils slowly for a while, and then they decide it's not boiling fast enough, I guess, and, you know, we hit each other where it hurts. And you get this news that really puts a damper on the market, hopefully short-lived. But I don't know if there's a stretch to say a parallel could be drawn between what's going on between us and China and what's going on between the Democrats and the Republicans right now. It's just sort of an escalation, hoping to have some resolution. And, you know, I've seen some articles say at least the government shutdown issue is likely to get worse before it's resolved. Maybe the same could be said about tensions between us and China, but it does. Hopefully we're not lulled to sleep. Hopefully there is a resolution there that's okay for both sides, and we get through that and we allow the market to kind of go back to focusing on actual economic numbers. But yeah, it's we're kind of in between two crises going on right now, it feels like, if not more.
And I just like to point out that I think, you know, this was all spurred by, you know, a single post, and we're off 2%, which I think just kind of goes to show how the markets are already in a very precarious, I don't want to call it precarious, but you know, they're at all-time highs coming off of, you know, massive gains, as Kevin pointed out, from you know, a handful of semiconductor stocks that are highly open to change due to geopolitical changes. So, you know, he didn't even name a number or anything. All he said was, you know, I don't like this. I'm thinking about more tariffs. Didn't name a number. And, you know, a meeting that was scheduled for next month in South Korea between him and Xi is off. You know, if we start to see hard numbers, you know, we could see, you know, some of the volatility that we saw back in April for, you know, about 5-6 days there before the walk back on Liberation Day. But yeah, I just think it's just good to, you know, keep a fresh mind on it. Don't get lulled to sleep by expecting, you know, the same resolution that we saw in April of just a slow crawl back and above and beyond. More to come here, I would say.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you're hard to know what to invest in right now, but there's an article on anything you could even think about investing in telling you that you really should or really shouldn't. Lately, it's been rare earth metal miners, or just generally speaking, metals, right? Which have been moving upwards for the last 6 to 9 months or so, but not just because of some of these trade issues, but just in general because of some of the isolationist policies potentially, right? You can read articles right now about like why that is, you know, is it like they're calling it a debasement strategy at this point, or debasement play, right? Is the US dollar continuing to be threatened or to be devalued? And if so, what should you be investing in? That's sort of, it's separate but related to some of these arguments or negotiations with China and other countries, but it is crazy how much, you know, gold never moves really historically unless you have situations like this that are very uncertain. And gold's up, I think you looked, Alex, before the pod, 50% this year. That's the biggest move I've seen in my lifetime, I think.
Year to date, yeah, it's up 50%. And
I'd done a little back of the napkin analysis with some help from ChatGPT, but I was curious around if what all of the flows that are going into gold had instead gone into treasuries, U.S. treasuries or U.S. assets, what would that look like? And I compared you know, the flows from gold, you know, estimated, you know, based on supply and demand, and then compared that to treasuries. It's actually a fairly small influence in treasuries from like a basis point perspective, surprisingly, like, you know, across the yield curve. It doesn't seem like you can make the argument that, oh, if US assets were attracting more demand, you know, instead of gold, could that lower the 10-year? It doesn't really seem like that's the case. But the flip side of that is, you know, it does seem like very small amounts of peel off demand from treasuries can have these big influence on asset prices, you know, outside of U.S. treasuries. You know, I thought it was kind of interesting. Again, back of the napkin. So this isn't, you know, official and all that, but it did all, you know, the numbers seem to check out in terms of, you know, the overall impact.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is it's just like gold is a much smaller market than U.S. treasuries, right? Which I would totally buy, right? I mean, we've talked on a recent podcast about how enormous the U.S. treasury supply, demand, and just holdings are, and how just enormous of a market that is, which makes it harder to move it, but also has a big influence on mortgage rates. Whereas gold, smaller market, you'll get a bigger move from $100 billion moving this way or another, which is $100 billion of treasuries is nothing.
Yep, for sure.
Well, we have to have a whole cast on metals if we keep having some of this crazy activity and just how it interacts with rates, right? So we can tie it all back to what, you know, what we're all dealing with today, which is where mortgage rates are. But again, they'll be a little bit lower come Tuesday, most likely, unless we get a shift in the market, because we touched that 4% on the treasury. That tends to be a little bit of a psychological barrier for people. You might see us go lower from there.
Yeah. Well, if we get any deeper into heavy metals, we're going to have to ask Jeff to, you know, whip out his guitar and start hitting on some Metallica and, you know,
somebody playing, had to say it.
Playing the hits.
Pantera, man.
Pantera, that's hard.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else, gentlemen?
I think that just about covers it.
Thanks, everybody. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. We had Justin Monahan from TradeWeb on last week talking with Jeff and got a little bit into the technical details of the MBS market. We talked a lot about MBS, right? And we talked about how TradeWeb is at the center of that, really. They have a majority of MBS trades that happen on that platform, which is pretty wild, and talked a little bit about how MBS affect mortgage rates and are generally influenced by prevailing rates throughout the country, throughout the world. So we thought it would be maybe a good time to pump the brakes for a second and kind of take a lateral move into a little bit of MBS 101. Like, what is a mortgage-backed security? Why does it exist? Why is it unique in the world? You know, why is an American MBS unique? And what should we be watching out for as originators, as borrowers, as secondary marketing people, just as mortgage interested parties? Why do we care about MBS? So we're just going to do like a 5-10 minute discussion about that with this crew. And I'm going to drive it along a little bit with some key points, but kind of starting with what is a mortgage-backed security, right? What is an MBS? I mean, it's really at its simplest level, it's a package of mortgages that gets bundled up and sold to investors, right? And we've talked about who those investors could be. They, you know, could be, it was the Fed for a while, can be individual investors through money managers. It could be pension funds, can be foreign governments, foreign entities. You know, basically there's there's some conformity to it, right? It's not as if these MBS are all created different. We've talked a lot about how you do have some MBS that maybe have small loan balances, high loan balances, certain geographic concentrations. But in general, they're pretty similar things, right? It's a bundled up package of mortgages with an average interest rate that then gets paid to whoever owns that bond or that package, right? And those
I think that the word securitize, you know, sometimes trips people up, but it's really just, you know, preparing, you know, an asset to be invested in. So it allows you to invest in an asset. So lots of things can be securitized. Even fun fact, David Bowie's music catalog has been securitized for investment. So you can invest in his music royalties. So it's really just about taking, you know, an asset, you know, in this case, mortgages, and then preparing that so that it becomes an investment instrument.
That is a fun fact. I got a fact that's not as fun, but it's interesting in this context. There's some $16 trillion in MBS floating around out there somewhere on any given day. So that's like half the national debt, which basically represents the debt of our houses, right, in America. So I thought that was kind of a cool stat. $16 trillion. So relative to what we were talking about earlier, what, you know, whatever the amount of gold is in the world that's being invested in, investing in MBS is like a $16 trillion business. So why does MBS exist, right? It may sound like a dumb question, but you have to go back a bit, almost 100 years, to really get to why MBS really became a thing in our country, in the U.S. Another fun fact, started with the New Deal, right? FDR's New Deal, if you all remember, I don't know, middle school, high school history class, 1938, on the heels of the Great Depression, created Fannie Mae, which, long story short, gave birth to like the 30-year fixed mortgage and just the implicit government backing of this security that could sort of socialize the risk and create liquidity for people to borrow like huge amounts of money to buy homes, and kind of led to the reason that during most eras and most times it's been doable for like a middle-class family to buy a home, right? It's weird to think about it, but in a lot of countries that's not even possible. It certainly isn't possible with a 30-year fixed mortgage. People will look at you funny if they come from like we have coworkers that live in Canada, and they'll ask you 10 questions about what a 30-year fixed is. And it's just a 30-year loan that has one rate in payment for 30 years. They can't believe it.
Yeah, it is. And I know we've talked about this before on the podcast, you know, very unique to the U.S. One of the points that you were making there, Jim, was kind of having the conformity of, you know, mortgage-backed security plays an important role in the overall market, because if we didn't have this, you know, kind of central standard of what a mortgage is so that it can be, you know, securitized and then prepped for investment, we'd have just a decentralized credit market across the country. And those credit markets wouldn't be as liquid because you don't have the conformity. You don't have the volume to be able to allow traders to know that there's going to be someone on the other side who's willing to buy or sell. And that whole, you know, component of the market helps keep interest rates net-net lower. If the credit market was decentralized, if there wasn't a conforming 30-year fix, maybe there is a California 30-year fix or a New York 30-year fix or Texas, and they just operated in those zones, those markets wouldn't be as liquid as having a national market, and then rates net-net would be higher. So we luck out on multiple fronts in the U.S. with this. We have, you know, lower interest rates because of the conformity of the market, the liquidity of the market. It's a fixed instrument. We have enough housing that it supports liquidity as well. Lasts for 30 years. It's, you know, very similar to like investing in U.S. treasuries with that implicit government-backed guarantee. So it's a really special, you know, market that we have here that we're all a part of. We all, you know, have some role in helping support that market, but, you know, sometimes don't always realize just how unique it is and all of the different factors that are help making it work.
Agreed. Yeah, it's easier to set a price and therefore everybody knows what it's worth, so it's easily traded. And that then contributes to rates, right? Contributes to what we're paying for mortgages. We've talked on here about how the Fed does not control mortgage rates. The MBS market does. The $16 trillion that are out there were once bought or sold, probably many times over bought and sold on the open market. And there's billions, if not trillions, every month that change hands, and everybody knows what that price is, but it's all based on supply and demand, right? And that's how we get to our mortgage rates that we post on our OBMMI or that you see on bank rate or you go to your bank and you get, and that's why that rate, you're not going to see a huge difference between two banks across the street from each other, let alone a bank in New York and a bank in California. They're all basing their pricing on the very same market that your lender does. What should we be watching out for, right? People talk about stocks more than anything. If you're watching the news, if you're reading the journal or wherever you look for your financial news, it's kind of tough to get to bond news, especially MBS. You hear about treasuries sometimes, which is like the largest debt market in the world. But as we said, $16 trillion outstanding in MBS, yet rarely talked about. So what do we want to keep an eye on? What are some simple things we can keep an eye on?
Yeah, if you kind of think about breaking down what that 30-year rate represents in terms of risk or, I guess, return to whoever is investing or lending that money, right? I mean, it, you know, we talk a lot about how mortgages follow treasuries pretty closely, but they don't always follow them exactly. So you kind of start with shamelessly steal a post I saw on LinkedIn, I think originally from Freddie Mac a few years ago, kind of like building up a mortgage rate. So you start with, call it a risk-free rate, right? The risk-free rate, you can assume it's kind of like the 10-year or, you know, some risk-free rate, even, you know, the Fed funds rate at some level, right? And then you start from there and you build it up and you say, all right, what is a, you know, a 30-year rate to a borrower represent? Well, the borrower isn't going to, you know, not every borrower is going to have that mortgage for 30 years, right? They're going to move, they're going to refinance. And so you're estimating, what is the return you need for a loan that lasts on average 5 to 7 years? And so you kind of blend in some sort of return of what you would expect to have for 5 to 7 years there. And then you think about, you know, what is the risk premium I need for these types of borrowers? And you add in a little bit of a chunk of rate on top of that rate from there. And you kind of keep building up with some of those types of things. And you say, all right, how much then at that point, now that I've got to this kind of baseline rate, what is that worth to me as an investor? And you kind of start there. And we, you know, we can kind of call that portion the secondary market rate, which is really the rate of return for these mortgage-backed securities. Not necessarily the rate to the borrower, but the rate of return for these mortgage-backed securities, almost. Super simplified, but just kind of some of the building blocks you can think about how to build up to that rate.
Yeah. What does that come out to? Like 3/4 of a percent to 1%. So, right. So we're going from like 4% for a 10-year today to closer to 5 for the return if you wanted to buy a bundle or a securitization or a bond full of mortgages, right? So you're at 5. But then it goes up from there, right? You've got then some kind of risk premium because the bond needs to be insured and the relative, you know, credit worthiness, I mean, this could be argued, but the relative credit worthiness of the average American homeowner is not perceived to be as good as that of the U.S. Treasury. So there's a guarantee fee. You hear us talk about G-fee, guarantee fee. So about 0.5% goes to like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac to insure that group of mortgages, right? So if one or 10 of them go delinquent, the bondholder always still gets their money. So that gets added on. So you're like 5.5%. Then you add servicing, right? The person or the entity that services the loan, meaning they take the payments, they collect if there's delinquencies, they send out statements, remit insurance and taxes, that sort of thing. That's always, you know, call it roughly a quarter point. So we're, what are we at? 5.75. Then you build in things like origination and LLPAs, right? There can be differences in people's credit from one person to another. Also people who originate these mortgages, some of you are out there listening, they have to get paid, right? So call that, all those things, another 0.25 to 0.75 of a point. So you're just over 6. So that's where we're at today, 4% on treasuries, 6.125 or so, hopefully a little bit lower by Tuesday on mortgages. So that's,
yeah. And that's kind of like the average rate where, you know, somebody holding that original mortgage backed security is worth kind of like 100% of the face value of the loan, what we would call par. Right. And then if you have, you know, some mortgage backed security that's below that in rate, it's going to be worth less than 100%, or some mortgage backed security that's above that in rate, it's going to be worth more than 100%. And, you know, again, you know, maybe here we can talk about then how do those values fluctuate on a minute to minute basis.
Right. That kind of ties it back to what you talked to Justin about last week. It goes back and back to what we talked about 6 minutes ago, which is that market, that supply and demand market that drives rates. So, and it gives us the ability to have different rates. Like not everybody gets exactly the same rate, but you will get the close to the same rate. Plus when you figure in what fees you're going to pay, like why would someone want a higher rate? You might ask, like, why would someone want a 6.5 or 6.75? Because that might allow your originator to give you a little money back for things like closing costs, especially on a refi where maybe you don't want to bring $10,000 in to pay for the rate and to pay for fees and LLPAs. Or maybe you want a much lower rate. You want 4.5%. You can do that. Most lenders will let you get a 4.5% rate, but you're going to have to bring a lot more money with you to the closing table to buy that, what they call buy that rate down, right? Because that bond is probably only going to go for 95 cents on the dollar because that rate that the bondholder is getting paid is closer to, you know, 3.5. They're going to not pay a full dollar for dollar on that because the yield is lower. I think that all made sense. So then, you know, what should we be watching out for? What might change in the near future? We've dabbled in this a little bit on these podcasts. As treasuries move, yields on mortgages are likely going to move very similar. But that spread that we've talked about that Jeff and I walked you through, that can change. And that has changed over the years with supply and demand and other things. And like it was really thin, for instance, when the Fed was buying because they're a buyer that they weren't in a position to do a lot of like analysis between should I buy gold or should I buy MBS, right? They were just buying MBS and treasuries at a crazy rate. But also the GSEs, for instance, used to buy MBS before the great financial crisis, before they were put into conservatorship. There's some people that think that could change. The FHFA may come in and say, you can buy MBS again so that you can better regulate that spread. I'm not saying it's going to happen, just some people think it might. And so that spread could go from the example we just talked about, which was close to 2%, could go a little bit lower if the GSEs want to build up their portfolio a little bit. And even I think news of something like that being a possibility could cause just others to jump in and want to buy those bonds because they're likely going to be worth more. And that would be, you know, that would put us into the fives right now, which would be kind of fun, kind of interesting. And it might be one of the nuclear options for the administration who really wants to do something about home affordability. And it would make an enormous difference.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just the thought of rates in the fives after several years in the sixes and sevens and pushing eight at times would be welcome news for sure. If we can get there.
For sure. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, there's other extraneous factors that could affect that spread, but a lot of it would probably have to be policy driven changes at the GSEs, changes with government bonds. But in general, otherwise you're looking at treasuries and you're looking at what affects them if you're wondering where rate's going to go. So things like Fed announcements can have an influence. They don't directly control, but can have an influence. Things that generally would lower rates, like bad jobs numbers, like we talk about every week. If we get a bad jobs number when the BLS gets this next report out, we will probably see rates continue to drop a little bit. That's the usual direction. But then again, then you get the CPI number, maybe that's a little bit hot and rates go up because the expectations are that the rates are higher. And just spend, you know, back to the supply and demand, just government spending more, any changes in news on that, which it always seems to be news that government spending is going to increase across the world, not just us, right? There's a lot of debt out there that needs to get bought. So the rates just continue to go higher to attract that cash.
Yep, for sure. I saw a take out there recently that was trying to explain how we might see bond yields moving sort of independently from equity prices in the current market, and that, you know, stock prices are tracking the AI economy. And because normally stocks and bonds move opposite each other, but stocks today are, you know, more tracking the AI economy, whereas, you know, treasury yields, bond yields are more closely tracking the labor market data. So, you know, those can move somewhat independently. So there's some days we see stocks go up, yields go down, and, you know, vice versa. So a lot of nuance to what's happening in the markets these days.
Yeah, a lot of different moving parts, as you said, and it's not always intuitive the way it used to be. But when you break it down, it ends up making sense that Yeah, bad jobs number means slower economy, probably should mean lower stocks, but should mean that the price of bonds goes up, right? Which brings the rates on bonds down. Cool, fun discussion. We should do this. We should just do this a couple times a year.
Yeah.
All right. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Wow, another great episode. Let's close this thing out. Thank you, Kevin, Jeff, Alex. Great discussion today. Talked a little bit about the market. I talked a little bit about MBS. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thank you again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Originators, you know the challenge. You want to stay in front of past clients, but digging through old loans and spreadsheets to find refinance opportunities, that's not exactly time well spent. Capture for Originators, available to Optimal Blue PPE users. Changes that by automatically analyzing entire past closed loan portfolios each month and putting recapture opportunities directly into your hands. No spreadsheets, no manual data pulls, just a streamlined experience powered by innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Turn missed opportunities into measurable wins with Capture for Originators. Check out optimalblue.com or reach out to your Optimal Blue client service representative for more information.